It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Protests, violence, and even deaths overshadowed voting Sunday in Venezuela. At least 10 people died, and people stayed away from the polls in large numbers. The vote called by President Nicolas Maduro might lead to unlimited powers for the ruling Socialist Party. The first vice president of Venezuela's Socialist Party, Diosdado Cabello, said all Venezuelans will ultimately benefit from what President Maduro is trying to do. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Sunday the United States would have to cut its embassy and consulate staff in Russia by 755 people, heightening tensions between Washington and Moscow 3 days after the U.S. Congress approved sanctions against Russia. Sergei Rybkov is the Russian deputy foreign minister. He appeared on the ABC News program this week with George Stephanopoulos.
I think the political will is what is needed most in this situation. And I believe there are several areas where U.S. and Russia can and should work together cooperatively. Non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, countering terrorism, illicit migration, trafficking in people, climate change, you name it. We are ready. We are stretching our hand forward.
In response, the U.S. State Department deemed all of this a regrettable and uncalled-for act on Russia's part. Al-Shabaab insurgents in Somalia claiming to have killed at least 40 African Union troops in an ambush on a convoy in the lower Shabelle region. Reporters from Reuters say 24 were killed. This is VOA News. President Trump has begun an urgent round of diplomatic consultations with Japan and South Korea, and North Korea's latest intercontinental ballistic missile test is the subject of their talks. He spoke by telephone with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Mr. Abe then spoke to reporters. The Japanese leader said he and Mr. Trump agreed that further action must be taken. There had been word from that the U.S., South Korea, and Japan would approach the U.N. Security Council for stricter measures against Pyongyang. After the latest missile test, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said they are confident their missiles have the capability of reaching the continental United States. U.S. military officials have confirmed the death of 4 additional senior Islamic State leaders in a July 11th airstrike in northeastern Afghanistan that also killed the top leader of the terrorist group. The drone attack struck IS headquarters in Kunar province, which borders Pakistan, and eliminated Abu Sayyid, the emir of Islamic State's self-styled Khorasan province branch. U.S. airstrikes have primarily been responsible for killing about 20 founding and some of the second-generation leaders of the Khorasan branch, which has launched extremist activities in the country for 2 years. Police Sunday said a gunman and a policeman were killed on Saturday during an attack on the home of Kenya's deputy president, William Ruto, just a week before national elections. Ruto and his family were not at home at the time of the attack. Police have not commented on a motive. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto attended an open-air mass Sunday ahead of next week's election. Mr. Kenyatta spoke to the crowd gathered at Uhuru Park.
To thank God for how far we have come, to ask for his favor for peace during the next couple of weeks, and to keep us as a people and as nation united with a clear recognition that this country was here before August the 8th and will be here after the election.
Polls show a tight race against opposition leader and presidential candidate Raila Odinga. And Jamaican sprint superstar Usain Bolt says he'll seek the limelight at the World Track Championships that's later this week in London. Get more news at our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Campaigning for Liberia's 2017 elections officially begins today, Monday.
The only message we have for everybody is to observe the rules, particularly those commitments that we've made, all of us, to ensure that the elections are free from violence. And we also expect that political parties would respect the rights of others.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of Liberia's Elections Commission. Rwanda enters the final week of campaigning, and the Elections Commission says all is ready for the vote on August 4th. And South Sudan rebels loyal to Riek Machar say they have regained control of the strategic town of Mainwood.
The government is not in control of Mainwood, but the SLIO is in control of Mainwood. So the governor, who is claiming to be the governor of Mainwood, is even not there.
Colonel Paul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. Kenyans of Asian descent are the country's 44th tribe, and a young Ethiopian immigrant returns home to help Ethiopian children. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's voice and our list of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Campaigning for Liberia's 2017 presidential and parliamentary elections officially begins today, Monday, and will close around midnight on October 8th, 2 days before ballots are cast. A total of 20 candidates are running for president, and 986 candidates are running for seats in parliament. National Elections Commission Chair Jerome Kokoya has appealed to all candidates and their political parties to ensure a violence-free election.
The only message we have for everybody is to observe the rules, particularly those commitments that we've made, all of us, to ensure that the elections are free from violence. And I have reference to the Ganta Agreement and the Famidon River Declaration, where the political parties got together and committed themselves to a violent-free process. And that is very good for us because everybody looks forward to a free, fair, a transparent process. You cannot have that with the least semblance of violence. So that's what we expect them to do during the campaign period. And we also expect that political parties and other independent candidates would respect the rights of others who are participating in the process. And in that regard, we've asked them for their schedule so that we can help to coordinate the various appearances they will make to avoid collision and conflict. We've also asked them to, in addition to complying with all of the rules that we have as Election Commission, there are also other public safety regulations that the government of Liberia has in place. And so we expect that political parties and all of those participating in the process will familiarize themselves with those rules as we go through. And that is exactly what we will want them to do.
Mr. Chairman, what is the total number of presidential candidates that you have in this election?
Yeah, we have a total of 20 presidential candidates. Two of the 20 are independent candidates, and the other 18 represent political parties.
There are some people who have been talking about affirmative action. Can you give us any figure in terms of female candidates versus male candidates?
We have only one female candidate on the side of the presidency. We would have loved to have more. We did everything with some very hard-working women group to ensure that women participate in the process to a larger extent. But we were only able to get one female candidate. I think there are, I think, two female vice presidential candidates as well. On the representative side, we got a couple of them. A little over 100. So the total female candidates in the race are presidential combined with representatives, I think amount to 163. I'm not too sure, but that is the total number we have. And we would have loved to have more, but that's all we could get.
Monday also, you released the final list of candidates, and you said here that your commission has emphasized that any candidate on the list of final candidates that is currently involved in matters that remain unresolved by the commission may be excluded from the list before the printing of ballots based on the final outcome. Do you have candidates that are currently involved in matters that have yet to be resolved?
Oh, yeah, sure. There are a couple of objections that have been filed against some candidates, especially the representative's side. I'm not too sure if they have any objection against any presidential candidate now, but there just might be some. But I just a caveat because the commission was not able to dispose of all of these matters before the time for a final listing. So what you just read is intended to put them on notice that should we find those objections to be against a particular person and they may be excluded as a result of the final outcome. Of course, you know, in Liberia, they have a right to appeal and to the Supreme Court. When we get rid of those matters at our level, and those who will be appealing will be watching the court, and once the court determines as a matter of finality, then those people against whom decision will be finally made, if they are placed on a candidate, may be excluded.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of Liberia's Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. This is the final week of campaigning for Rwanda's August 4th presidential election, the country's third since the 1994 genocide. President Paul Kagame, who some say engineered a referendum to change presidential term limits, is running for a third term, and if he wins, would remain in power until 2034. Charles Muyaneza, Executive Secretary of the National Elections Commission of Rwanda, says the commission is ready to preside over a free and fair election process. He says starting today, Monday, the commission will begin distributing election materials to the districts. Muyaneza says his commission has already accredited 1,800 election observers. He denies that the commission disqualified candidates considered to be a threat to President Kagame.
As you mentioned, we are in the last stages of election campaigns. Election campaigns are supposed to be ending on that. And so far, we find the process going on well. People are turning up in large numbers. The candidates are conducting themselves well. And as we talk now, tomorrow, we shall start transporting election materials from national headquarters to districts. And finally, on Saturday, 6 p.m., we should have all the election materials in place. So everything is now in place. We have already trained over 70,000 election volunteers. We have already prepared each and every election material. We have printed all the ballot papers that we need. We have already accredited over 1,800 election observers. And so far we are meeting them. Everything is set for the 4th of August presidential elections.
Besides President Paul Kagame, how many presidential candidates do you have?
Besides His Excellency President Paul Kagame, we've got Mr. Habineza Frank and Mr. Mahimana Philip. These are two candidates. Mr. Habineza Frank is representing the Democratic Union part of Rwanda, and Mr. Mahimana Philip is an independent candidate.
Help me understand. I read an article that said that some candidates were disqualified or rejected. For example, the article mentioned Ms. Diane Shima Rigara, who, according to the article, was going to be a potent challenger. Could you tell us why she was rejected?
Diane and any other candidate that was disqualified according to the provisions of the electoral law. It is not her alone that was disqualified. We had two other candidates. We had somebody called Barasinda Fred Sechikubo. We also had Mene Data Hilbert. These others were also disqualified, just as Diane Shima was disqualified. So whatever we followed was based on the law, and basically they could not raise the 600 signatures at national level that was required, and at least 12 people signing in support of their candidature in each of the 30 districts that we have. So analyzing these files, analyzing their signatures, we discovered some anomalies. Either way, we had time to announce provisional list of candidates, and we gave them another 5 days to fix whatever was not in accordance with the law, and they couldn't raise the signature that was required. Particularly for the candidates, for the aspiring candidates that you just mentioned, we discovered some anomalies in the people who had signed for her. Some of the people who had signed for her had signatures that could not match with the signatures that we had in our database.
Can you tell us that the elections are going to be free and fair?
That is our commitment. We are a public body. We are in the service of the people of Rwanda. The only service that we offer in the National Electoral Commission is clean, free, and fair elections, and we do pledge and we commit Rwandans that this is our mission and we are going to proceed. We are committed. We've got very professional people. We've got commissioners. We've got staff. We've got volunteers. We put everything in place. And by the way, we've got almost everybody on board. As I was saying, we have accredited over 1,800 election observers, both international but also domestic observers. These are the people who have been accredited and are out there to see if the law is being followed to the last. We have also entered into memoranda. We have entered into partnership and synergy with different stakeholders to make sure that elections are not a property of the National Electoral Commission. The political parties are on board, and we have also allowed the candidates to have agents representing them in each of the 16,000 polling stations that we have. All this is to make sure that the process is transparent.
Charles Moyaneza is the Executive Secretary of the National Elections Commission of Rwanda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. And today is Monday, July 31st. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar say they have regained control of the strategic town of Mawut. The South Sudan government said on Friday that it had taken Mawut, the last town before the main rebel base of Pagat. On Sunday, Mawut State Governor Major General Bo Ruak Rum texted VOA to say that Major General Peter Tajia Rum and others were alive and with him in Mawut. But Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, says Mawut is back under the control of rebel forces.
The truth is, on the 27th, the government entered Mawut at about 7 a.m. and we had clash with them until about 10 a.m. when our forces decided to technically withdraw due to pressure from our commanders in the field. So they stayed in Mawut for 2 days. But yesterday, we went back after reinforcing, and we took out Mawut. We are in control of Mawut right now. So if the government is not in control of Mawut, but the SLIO is in control of Mawut, so the governor who is claiming to be the governor of Mawut is even not there. Those who came to Mawut, they do not have anybody called governor in there.
And who is this Major General Peter Tajia Rum? Is he one of your generals?
Not one of our generals. This is one of the generals that comes with the government forces and was one heading the government going to attack. He was one who attacked Mawut. So he is not one of our generals, but he is among those who were killed in Mawut. So this of claiming he's alive, let him prove him. Let him prove us, give him his proof of life. He is there. But the truth is, he's dead.
The governor, in his text message to me, said that the general is alive, that he and the general went to church.
They are lying. There is no any government forces in Mawut at the moment. The truth is, the SLIO is in Mawut. We are in full control of Mawut, and we are still taking control of Mawut. Up to today, we are still in control of Mawut. There are no civilians right now in Mawut. The civilians have all run away due to the presence of government there before. So they should not lie to people that there are civilians in Mawut. No, there are no civilians in Mawut.
What can you tell me also about this report that at least 20,000 of your troops have allegedly declared allegiance to the National Salvation Front? Is this true?
No, that is not true. There's only one person who went to the National Salvation Army. That was 2 days ago. We have Lieutenant General John Kenyanga to you. He joined the National Salvation Army, and he declared that 2 days ago. So we were in contact with him because, you know, John Kenyanga has been having discipline cases. He has been disarming our forces and also removing our guns, restoring our bullets, our ammunition. So when he decided to go to NAS, we called him and requested for our ammunition and our weapon that he disarmed from our soldiers. He refused to give them. And this morning, what happened is our reconnaissance team came across his forces in a place called Nyori in Ye River State. They clashed. After clashing, our reconnaissance force decided to go inside his base and flush him out. Right now, he's on the run.
So you are saying that Maiwut is still under the control of the SPLAIO, is that correct?
That is correct. Maiwut is still under the control of SPLAIO.
Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He said he was speaking with me from the Ugandan-South Sudan border. Kenya has officially recognized Kenyan nationals of Asian descent as the country's 44th tribe. The move, while largely symbolic, reflects the historic and economic contributions of the Indian community in the East African country. Supporters in the community hope that the tribal designation will mark the start of greater political engagement. Rial Ombo reports from Nairobi.
Kenyans of South Asian descent, commonly referred to as Muindis in Kenya, are now the country's 44th tribe. Fred Matiang'i, Kenya's acting Minister of Interior, made the announcement July 21st on behalf of Kenya's president.
Now you are part and parcel of us formally. You are part and parcel of Kenya's great family. And we expect that we will continue this integration in all spheres of life, socially, culturally, economically, and actually, even in terms of participation in government and government processes.
Indians started coming into East Africa in the 17th century. The advent of colonial rule then expanded businesses and employment opportunities, including serving in the British Army in East Africa and building the Kenya-Uganda Railway. Shakil Shabir's father was among the thousands of Indian laborers who built the railway of a century ago. Shabir's family remained in Kenya, and the MP is now one of the four elected officials of Asian descent in Kenya. Shabir told VOA that while Indians have enjoyed economic success in Kenya for generations, many have remained on the sidelines politically. He hopes the tribal designation will change that.
You feel more comfortable now than you did before? Okay, maybe it was a cultural thing. Maybe you needed to be recognized. We've recognized you. Now what? It's a two-way job. You've been recognized by the system. Now we want you to now take your role in society.
The tribal designation recognizes Kenya of Asian descent who already have Kenya nationality, meaning their parents were born in Kenya. Farah Manzoor is a fifth-generation Kenyan of Indian descent. She's also an activist who spearheaded the quest for recognition beginning in 2010.
How it will help us, you know, like in the parliament even, okay, the Muindis have been there. But now we are a minority, okay, we are a tribe. We will be given allocations. Okay, in Paris statutes, not all of us, I'm not saying it should be given to all of us, but you will see Muindis now in government institutions.
While the tribal designation may raise the community's profile, it does not confer specific rights and privileges. Not everyone sees the point. Zahid Rajan is a writer and a member of the Kenya Asian Forum Steering Committee.
In terms of our rights and our participation, Kenyans as a whole have been marginalized. You know, the outcry in the body politic is that we want inclusivity in governance, you know, and in the running of our own life. That inclusivity right now does not exist because you've got dominance of one or two ethnic groups. I think to push for the rights of a minority community to seek special status is both wrong and divisive.
Critics see political calculation in the timing of the government's announcement. With hotly contested nationwide elections just weeks away, the community of Kenyans of Asian descent number in the tens of thousands. The latest census data from 2009 puts the total at just over 46,000. Kenya's decision has revived activism in the Indian community in neighboring Uganda. Activists there are reiterating the call they made to President Yoweri Museveni in 2014 to amend the constitution to make them Uganda's 66th tribe. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A young Ethiopian immigrant who spent most of her life in the United States has founded a project to give back to her country of birth. VOA's Amber Wishi has more.
Bags boasting the colors of the Ethiopian flag are being stuffed with medical supplies and donated clothes. The 100 bags will be hand-delivered to people in Ethiopia's capital. College student Tracy DeMiss made it all possible. She immigrated to the United States from Ethiopia at the age of 6 and has now launched the Ethiopia Lajoch Project. The name translates to Children of Ethiopia. The country is her motherland, and Demis feels that it's her duty to give back to her people, especially children.
These children are worrying about like what food they're gonna have or what like clothes they're gonna wear.
About 30% of Ethiopia's 100 million people live in poverty. Demis says her parents always helped those in need, and she is carrying on that tradition. She flew to Ethiopia this month to personally distribute her bags. Half will be given to those on the streets of Addis Ababa, and the other half donated to shelters. Demis received help from Project WISE, an American-based organization that empowers millennial immigrants.
This project means a lot to me because I want to make a real impact, especially in Africa and those who are less fortunate and don't have the opportunity as we do in America.
Amber Wishy, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin in South Africa, where the Minister of Sports and Recreation, Thula Nkosi, has announced that he will institute a ministerial commission of inquiry into the cause of Saturday's stampede at the FNB Stadium in Soweto. Two football fans were killed and 17 others were injured during the local derby involving Soweto Giants, Kaizer Chiefs and Orlando Pirates during the Carling Black Label Cup.
We will immediately constitute a ministerial committee of inquiry to investigate the circumstances that have led to that particular tragedy.
Wayne Mina of the Johannesburg Metro Police also confirmed that a high-level probe is already underway to ascertain the cause of the stampede.
There was a stampede or pushing at some of the entrances, and that had resulted in a very sad situation. We know that the matter has been investigated, and all other allegations as to why it had happened is being investigated.
And now to Uganda, where the national football team coach Milutin Micho Sridejovic has left his job as Ugandan Cranes coach following a pay dispute with the Football Federation. Micho accuses FUFA of failing to honor the contract to pay him his dues for 6 months.
Despite stretching over all human and economical limits, FUFA has not succeeded to make even one practical step towards showing intention of things being sorted. My agent and myself, we have practically contract has been terminated.
Highlights of the four-year reign of the Serbian coach was guiding the Cranes to a first African Cup of Nations appearance in 39 years. Several clubs, including South African Giants, Orlando Pirates, Egypt's Zamalek, and an unnamed Libyan club, have been linked as potential destination. In other sports news, Kenya women's volleyball team are the overall winners of the 2018 Zone 5 World Championship qualifying tournament thanks to a 25-18, 25-17, 25-17 win against their perennial rivals Egypt at the Kasarani Indoor Arena on Sunday. Kenya finished the event top with 9 points ahead of Egypt with 6 points, but both teams qualified for the African Nations Cup and the World Championship qualifier to be staged in Cameroon later in the year. Tunisia finished 7th at the 2017 IHF Men's Junior World Championship after beating Russia 36-21 on Sunday in Algiers at a placement game. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very productive week.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll preview the August 8th Kenyan presidential race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga. The latest public opinion polls say the ballot is too close to call. That's on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.